Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you meet the two brothers who founded one of the most successful apparel companies in America, Life is Good. In part two, from the archives, you'll hear the story of a Microsoft executive who gave all of that up to move to Nepal to help put books into the hands of youngsters there. An inspiring hour ahead on the morning show here on WGTD. I have a feeling that many of you have in your closets at home what I have in my closet as well. Beautiful, wonderful, comfortable, inspiring t-shirts and sweatshirts with the label Life is Good. And on top of that, maybe you have baseball caps or dog leashes or even a really neat little book called Life is Good, Simple Words from Jake and Rocket. This is an extraordinarily successful company. Created and run by two brothers, Bert and John Jacobs. And the whole idea behind the marvelous products which they create is to spread the power of optimism. And they do that in all kinds of different ways. And one of the best things about the company Life is Good is that they do so many things to make the world a better place, not only donating 10% of their profits right off the top to some very, very worthy charities, but also in the way that they conduct their business and interact with their customers, they are doing so much good. They have a book called Life is Good, The Book, How to Live with Purpose and Enjoy the Ride, in which they lay out not only the lives of optimism which they have lived and where that optimistic spirit came from, but also lay out for us, the readers, 10 different superpowers which aid them in living the lives that they do. And it's an absolutely terrific book. I already plan to get several of them and share them as gifts. It's not often I say that so blatantly over the air, but I have no hesitancy in saying it about this book called Life is Good. And I'm thrilled to be able to speak with Bert and John Jacobs, the founders of Life is Good and the co-authors of this absolutely terrific book. Bert and John Jacobs, we welcome you to the morning show.
We really appreciate you having us on.
Happy to be talking to you. Really happy to be talking to you. I wish we had more time to be able to talk about something that's really delicious in your book, which is your account of your childhood, which you call Our Perfectly Imperfect Childhood, in which you say your folks have bitten off a lot by trying to raise a family of six kids on a slim salary. A familiar story, I'm sure, to a lot of people. One of the things you say, though, is your mom was the first powerful optimist in your lives. Tell our listeners some of the ways in which that powerful optimism was lived out and made such a deep impression on you.
Yeah, there were really, you know, every family faces challenges, and there were really two major factors in our childhood that were challenging. One was economics and maybe too many kids and not enough money. And the other was that our parents had a near-death car accident when we were in grade school. And our mom had a seatbelt on and so survived with only broken bones. Dad almost died and ended up losing the use of his right arm. And he became heavily depressed, and yelling and screaming in the household became a daily soundtrack. And that was extremely challenging, but our mom was the one that really kept the family together. And she did so by focusing on what was right rather than what was wrong. So she had a tradition at the dinner table where she looked around and said to all of us, "Tell me something good that happened today." And as simple as that request was, it changed the energy in the house. So, you know, years later as adults, when we kind of landed on our feet and started selling T-shirts, it became a huge factor in, you know, sort of funneling us towards a more optimistic message, which ended up being life is good. So our mom really was the first powerful optimist in our lives, taught us a lot, and was the inspiration for life is good.
And we'll talk a little more about her story before we're done. Explain to our listeners how and why you first got the idea of trying to make your living selling T-shirts. It sounds like there were a couple of different things at play in your mind, and we're talking about your first efforts before you ultimately founded this incredibly successful company. But in the early going, with that really modest beginning, what was at the heart of choosing that as what you hoped would be a path to success?
Well, I think we felt T-shirts were a great canvas for messages. We've always liked to write and draw since we were kids. Our mom was an artist, and I encouraged that sort of thing. And we also looked at it as an accessible way to combine art and business. And we were looking, as we got to college and talked more and more about what we wanted to do, we didn't really know, but we thought it would be incredible to be able to create art for a living somehow, and that's what led us to T-shirts, and then we just gave it a shot. We went to a screen printer, and we took to the streets of Boston, and then you know, bought this used van and started going up and down the East Coast selling in college dorms.
One of the things I appreciated about your book is you really lay out the tough road that was, and I'd heard some relatively vague accounts about how you started really small and it was not easy in the early going, but wow, you guys really hit some walls and a lot of people who were not at all receptive to what you were doing, and it seems like this was one of those paths of great discouragement, and somehow your optimistic spirit survived that.
Yeah, I think in one way to look at it is it's all we had. You know, we didn't have money, we didn't have experience, and we really didn't have professional skills, but we had a message that, or even before life is good, we did have the optimism. We had that, you know, taught to us since we were kids. So, you know, one thing that prevents people from starting businesses and taking risks or chasing their dreams is that they're afraid to fail. And one thing that an optimist can do, and it was very powerful to us early on, was we didn't look at days as failures where we didn't sell any T-shirts. So we could be in the street selling all day and at night in the dormitories and not sell a single T-shirt. And rather than saying we failed today, we would look at it and say we learned today. What did we learn? We didn't sell those shirts for a reason. Either we had the wrong graphic, or we had the wrong color, or we were in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we can improve based on that. We looked at it as a benefit that we learned. And then the next day, you know, of course, you can't have too many of those days in a row. So the next day, you have to make adjustments and get out in the market and do something different. I think, you know, the way you frame things and the way you view the world is very powerful. And that's what optimism is about. A pessimist will focus on the obstacles, but an optimist will focus on the opportunities. And that's kind of what kept us going in the early days.
I love the phrase at one point in the book when you describe these early days as a lot of trial and even more error. But at some point...
we've made a lot of mistakes.
At some point, though, you ended up creating this now iconic figure known as Jake. Just briefly describe kind of the moment when there was that creative spark, and in particular the person who kind of saw that drawing and said something about it that really kind of drew it all together.
Yeah, so this was a big lesson to us that ends up kind of continuing throughout our whole careers with Life is Good. One conversation while we were traveling in the van was about the fact that the media is almost systematic pessimism in that it inundates our culture with negative information, always reinforcing what's going wrong in the world. And we wanted to create some symbol that celebrated what's right with the world. So J.J. drew Jake with crayon and magic markers, the original character, and when we got back to Boston, we had a tradition of throwing a keg party. We put all of our artwork up on the walls, and a girl who was at the party drew an arrow to Jake and wrote, it didn't say life is good, it didn't say, you know, she just wrote, this guy's got life figured out. And we loved that, but we realized it was too many words, so in the morning we distilled that into the three words, life is good, and that was it. So the lesson, you know, 2 days later we sold them in the street, we sold 48 t-shirts in 45 minutes, and it was immediately commercially viable, but the lesson was that we didn't have to come up with it. You know, people will help you and people will come up with ideas for you if you enable them. That's, you know, part of why, you know, one of the superpowers is openness. You have to be open to people. So immediately that girl at that party, she kind of gave it to us without knowing it. We were searching for something, but in a sense, she came up with it, you know. And then we were smart enough to distill it and then to trademark it. And, you know, that continues, as I said. So, like, the retailers then evolved our brand for us. And today it still continues. It's our customer base that's building the business with us.
Hmm.
And if I could add, you know, the customers that taught us the most were the ones that wrote these incredibly personal stories about going through adversity and, you know, whether it's chemotherapy, losing loved ones, and they would say that optimism helped them, you know, focus on what they should be grateful for, just for having a sandwich, just for having a friend to talk to, just for hanging out with their dog, and these simple pleasures that we often take for granted. People that go through tremendous adversity, they have this heightened sense of gratitude. And so to Bert's point, you know, we learn from our friends at the keg party, then the retailers, then, you know, this deepest message of all was like that life is not perfect, life is not easy, but life is good. And especially if you're able to focus on what's right in your life and the world and grow that good.
Mm.
And that's where these superpowers, you know, we call them superpowers. They're values that are accessible to everybody, and they all come from our customers. So, you know, you get enough letters from people that are going through really difficult things, and they express that they're so appreciative of what they have in their life that you realize that gratitude is a superpower. You get enough letters from people that say, you know, what they're drawn to about life is good is the simplicity of it. It's childlike. It's so simple. Their life is so complex. There's too much information, et cetera, and they want to just focus on the things that they love. So simplicity to us becomes a superpower. You know, the same is true of creativity, of authenticity, openness, courage, all of these things that are kind of timeless. But the more, all we had to do was kind of listen to our customer base, and over time, these things showed up so many times over and over that we said, okay, that's it. Those are the things that are enabled by this this thing we call optimism. And maybe the most important thing is that optimism really isn't a soft philosophy. It's a pragmatic strategy for approaching life. And, you know, the more we practice it, the more we wake up in the morning and say, okay, you know, how do I focus on what's right in my life rather than what's wrong? That's the things that are going to grow. We're able to put our resources towards making our life happier and more fulfilling.
We're speaking with Bert and John Jacobs, the founders of the company Life is Good, and we're talking specifically about a really terrific book that has just been published by National Geographic, actually, called Life is Good, the book. And yes, indeed, the heart and soul of this book is the array of 10 superpowers, as you call them, that can be, in a sense, the ingredients to a truly optimistic life. When you talk about openness in the first chapter, you talk about two words that are so important, and those words are yes and, saying a quick no stops the flow, yes and lets you build and grow. And that's really a way in which you've lived that out in the way that you've grown your company.
Yeah, you know, that phrase originated from improv comedy, and that's the secret to why actors can get on stage and support each other and create a scene out of nothing, nothing but a suggestion. And it's amazing to watch live, but you can actually apply it to your everyday personal life, work. I mean, we've all been in meetings where people are afraid to offer new ideas because, the first instinct sometimes is for others to talk about why it won't work. If you flip that and just kind of roll, give it a few minutes to breathe and say, yes, I like that, and what if we do this as well? The momentum is, like, unstoppable. You can always edit it out at the end of the meeting and decide to go in another direction, but to give ideas a little chance to breathe and grow is huge. And think about that in your personal life. Your friend wants to take an adult ed class, or your spouse or something. Instead of telling them why that doesn't make sense or you're too busy, yes, and maybe, you know, I'd love to take that with you, or I've been thinking about taking this class. Any conversation can be aided by that simple phrase.
The second chapter is devoted to courage, and in this chapter you tell an incredible story about your sister, Berta, and a devastating injury which she suffers while in a skiing accident, and her remarkable comeback. It must have been especially touching for you to share this kind of a story which had such a powerful connection to the two of you so directly.
It was hard, yeah. You have feelings for a long time. I mean, our sister, it was a paralyzing ski accident. She'll, immediately following the accident, she was completely paralyzed, unable to move. But over time, in our opinion, her courage, her optimism, her openness, and a great team of doctors, enabled her recovery. And while her body will never be the same, the important thing to us is that the accident caused her tremendous pain and difficulty in her life, but it never took her beautiful smile away, because she knows that's who she is, you know. And so the courage to embrace and to rehab and to work her way back as best she could is a superpower. But, you know, the authenticity superpower is there too, because she kept that smile through everything and has been a huge inspiration to us. She asked herself, you know, when she was in the hospital, you know, what are her choices? You know, she could frown and or she could smile. And she said, if the smile is the courageous choice, that's an easy one for me, because if I get upset, how's that going to affect my family and everybody else? So, you know, she thought about everybody else involved. And so she's been just a huge inspiration to us.
And that mental switch went off in the hospital, she said, where she said, I'm going to focus on the progress. You know, and every little bit, she wiggled a toe one day. She moved her hands. And that was like where she focused all her energy, on what was the next step of progress. And that's something we can all learn from.
I love the quote you have of her at one point saying, every step of the way, I felt lucky. I mean, it's amazing when someone in the midst of something like that.
To this day, she has tremendous challenges, you know, and setbacks. But she says, another one I love that she said is, I don't let it ruin, you know, it's going to ruin my next 10 minutes, but I'm not going to let it ruin my next hour. And that's how she looks at these things that would frustrate us all very much, because her hands don't work very well and she doesn't move around too well. But she does not dwell on that stuff. She's a real inspiration to us all.
I'm sure. You talk so beautifully about simplicity, the importance of, in your words, chiseling away at the excess and cutting to the core. You quote Thoreau and Leonardo da Vinci saying that simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, which I like so much. I appreciate what you write in one chapter about humor and in another chapter about fun. And about fun, you say that fun is more than just frivolous. It really can make an enormous difference. And it sounds like you take fun very seriously at Life is Good. I mean, even in terms of how you conduct your business, the way your workplace is put together, you really are anxious to foster that.
Yeah, absolutely. Saying, we've found that in general in business and adults in general, we we tend to get away from that superpower fun, and you know, it's magnetic. It really draws people in. It's attractive, and we've found that for our staff, they're actually more productive, and we're more productive together when we're able to have some fun. So we talk about blurring the line between work and play, and you know, this idea of hump day on Wednesday and grinding through your work week, and even the phrase work-life balance doesn't make sense to us, because you know, by very definition, that would mean that they counter or oppose each other, and that doesn't make sense. I think the better approach, regardless of what you do for a living, is, you know, find some fun in the week. Find some way to bring fun and bring the things that you love to your office, to your work, because the chances are, if you're able to do that, you're going to be more passionate about your work. You're going to be more enthusiastic about it, and you're going to attract better, stronger, more talented people, because who doesn't want to have some fun?
And as especially as we become adults, that has to be a conscious decision to inject fun. I'm going to bring fun and a certain energy to my coworkers, to when I get home from work. And we find, as Bert said, it's unifying, and it kind of lifts the whole team and actually makes you more productive, in addition to making the workplace a lot more enjoyable.
You also talk about compassion, creativity, authenticity when you talk about dogs, and you end with love. Nothing is stronger than love. A beautiful account of in the wake of the Boston Marathon. Your company is based in Boston, and how you responded to that tragedy. And the book ends with an absolutely lovely account of your mother's courageous battle with cancer, and what an inspiration she was to all of you right to the end. Life is good, you say, is the Swiss Army knife of gratitude. I want to finish there. Explain that phrase. Life is good is the Swiss Army knife of gratitude.
Well, it's actually the phrase that we refer to there. It's get to, and it was one we picked up from our community. And it's the idea that you don't choose to say, I have to go, you know, to a meeting. I have to go grocery shopping. I have to do the laundry. You get to go to a meeting because you have a job. You get to do the bills because you have a roof over your head. You get to go grocery shopping because you live in a world of, you know, a land of abundance, and you've got eyes to read the labels. I mean, it's a simple one-word switch, but we learned it from our community, and it's extremely powerful. We apply it to work and home, and we feel like it's the Swiss Army knife of gratitude.
And we get to be on the road right now for 60 days. And one thing we want to enable people to do is help us raise money for kids while we're on the road promoting this book. If people hashtag grow the good and tell us something good that happened today, then we're going to donate another dollar to kids who need it. We've raised over $11 million for kids who need it, and we're very ambitious about raising more. So your listeners, just hashtag life is good. Hashtag grow the good, and for every hashtag, we'll donate another dollar.
Wonderful.
Think of that. I mean, that benefits the person writing it, because they're focused on thinking about the highlight, just like our mom taught us at the dinner table. And it's benefiting whoever's reading it. You know, they're reading that instead of hearing about the latest disaster. And we feel like that's really powerful around the world.
Of course. This new book is just terrific, start to finish. Again, it's called Life is Good, The Book, How to Live with Purpose and Enjoy the Ride, published by National Geographic and written by the co-creators of Life is Good, Bert and John Jacobs. Bert and John Jacobs, thank you so much for all that you do, and thank you for creating this terrific book. I am so glad we got to talk about it today. Best wishes to you.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much, Greg. Have a good one.
It's 8:34, and part two of today's morning show, an interesting interview out of the archives, is coming up next here on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. We are going to be hearing the story today of a life utterly transformed. The young man in question, John Wood, who had achieved tremendous success at one of the world's most successful companies, Microsoft. He had risen up the ranks there to become director of their operations in China, but something drew him away into another experience. Taking a break from the stress, he went on a vacation to Nepal, and little did he know that his life would be utterly changed. John Wood ultimately left Microsoft for an utterly different life, creating a wonderful organization called Room to Read, which has changed the lives of all kinds of young people in Nepal, putting books into the hands of children who had never held a book in their hands, created libraries, scholarships, bringing the blessing of education to all kinds of young people who otherwise would have not even known enough to dream of such a thing. And John Wood has helped to make that all possible. And this book, which he has written, Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, is actually a book not only about that, but also about how anyone who undertakes this kind of good work should probably do so mindful of some of the lessons that can be learned from the world of profit. That the profit sector can teach the nonprofit a thing or two about how to make things happen and to bring about the exciting change which one might be anxious to have. Room to Read was founded back in 2000 and has gone on to promote literacy in Nepal, India, Sri Lanka, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and very soon in Africa. John Wood, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Absolutely incredible privilege for me to speak with you. One of the things I wonder is that as we read about the tremendous success that you had climbing the ladder at a very competitive place like Microsoft, even at the time that all of that was occurring, did you feel like deep in your soul you were sort of on some level kind of a misfit there, or this was not the life for you? Or when you were at Microsoft, for the most part, did you feel like this is what my life was meant to be?
Well, I think when I was at Microsoft, I did fit in. I did well. I got promoted and all that. So in that sense, I don't think I was too much of an iconoclast, but I do think that I was a little bit different in that as the company was doing well and as I was making money from the stock, I started thinking pretty immediately about what can I do with this? I mean, what would be a great way to respond to this good fortune I've been given? And my parents always taught me that if you have a lot of money, it doesn't make you a good person. The question is, what do you do with it? And do you use it for the betterment of other people's lives, or do you just kind of, you know, waste it away on yourselves? And so in my case, I just started thinking to myself, is there a way that I could help other kids get education? Because education's meant a lot to me. It's made a big impact on my life. Is there something I can do to help other kids to get educated?
Tell us about this actually intriguing trip you took. I mean, in some respects, the way it's described, it on one level almost seems like kind of an accident that you find yourself trekking through the mountains of Nepal. And yet in other ways, we get this sense that you were in search of something. Help us understand that. Was it one or the other or a little of both?
I think I was definitely searching for something to figure out kind of what would life after Microsoft be for me. I've been thinking about whether or not there was something I could do. Would it be a startup company? Would it be going to a totally different industry and using my marketing skills? Would I go be, you know, the marketing director at a ski resort for a few years? And when I was trekking in Nepal, I was really looking for answers. And I didn't really know where I'd find the answers or if I would find the answers, but I think I was very open to the idea of making a transition in my life. In this case, when I met a headmaster in Nepal who invited me to come see his school, I was absolutely blown away by just the conditions the children were learning in. They, you know, sheet metal roof that leaked, the dirt floor, 75 kids crammed into a room that could fit about 25 comfortably. And most importantly, the school's library was completely devoid of books. The sign above the door said library, but in reality, inside that library, there were no shelves, no desks, and most importantly, no books. And so I started talking to the headmaster, and I said, you have 450 students, you don't have a library, is that a problem for you? And he said, yes, and actually chapter one of my book is titled, quote, perhaps, sir, you will someday come back with books.
Mm.
And that was the request the headmaster made, and I shook his hand, and I smiled, and I said, you will see me again. I love reading. I will come back here with as many books as you have children.
Mm. I thought an interesting moment in that chapter was when you asked him if the children of that village and of that nation, for that matter, were eager learners. I thought that was such an interesting question, and his answer is an interesting answer.
Oh, yes. He was telling me that the children were so eager to learn, but they had so few books at their disposal, and that really these kids, if they could just get their hands on books, they would have a brighter future. They'd be able to learn their own language, learn about health care, learn English, perhaps become trekking guides, you name it. The sky's the limit with education. And I think so many of us in the States, we have this benefit of having had Andrew Carnegie establish 3,000 libraries across North America. And even today, 100 years after Carnegie is dead, those libraries are still paying dividends each and every day for literally millions of people. And so when I was looking at doing this library in Nepal, I went and did research and I asked myself, who is the Andrew Carnegie of the developing world? Is there an Andrew Carnegie of Africa? Is there an Andrew Carnegie of India? Is there an Andrew Carnegie of Southeast Asia? And unfortunately, there just wasn't. There was no group or person doing this library type work on a massive scale. And so, not lacking in ambition, I decided that I would try to go out and raise enough money and get enough people involved so that we could actually be the Carnegie of the developing world.
John Wood, we are recording this interview on the 8th of September. I don't remember from the promotional materials if you are doing these interviews today because today is International Literacy Day, or were you aware of that?
I was aware of it, and we're very excited. Our teams around the world are celebrating International Literacy Day at a number of our libraries today.
Very good. I just had a conversation on this same morning show program yesterday with members of our local literacy councils talking about the gift of literacy, the blessing which it is for people of all ages, of course. You cite in your book a staggering statistic of 70% illiteracy rate in Nepal at the time that you first came there. It's hard to imagine the way in which that would affect life for the people there. That's something you can tell us about firsthand.
Yes, I think that so much of the developing world is stuck in this very terrible catch-22, where they are too poor to afford universal education. Yet, until they have universal education, one wonders how they will not be poor. And I liken a lot of the developing world to, you know, kind of the Little House in the Prairie era in America, where you might have a small town that, you know, has a one-room schoolhouse and one teacher and no library and very few books. And that's the situation, unfortunately, in a lot of the world today. There's nearly a billion people today who are illiterate. The United Nations estimates over 800 million people lack basic literacy. And if you think about that, I mean, how can we live in a world with this much material abundance and yet have nearly a billion people not able to read or write their name? And I think a lot of the problems in the world today stem from the fact that we just have not gotten kids educated from a young age. And so what we're really trying to do is take a very big, very bold step in getting out to at least 10 million kids with new schools and libraries.
I thought, going back to that conversation, that first conversation that we were just talking about, something else that is mentioned there is that, for instance, in that little village, there was a primary school, but there was no secondary school, and that if a child and their family was interested in their education proceeding beyond the fourth or fifth grade, it involved walking 2 hours to a far-off secondary school. And of course, we're talking about a family and a child making the decision not only to do that, but also taking that child away from the family for that length of time when it might be necessary for them, in fact, to be put to work. It's just terrible to think about families being put in that kind of situation, facing that kind of really difficult choice.
Yes, it's really quite tragic, and it's tough to imagine a world where that many children don't go to school. If you look at a place like India, you know, half the girls never even make it through secondary school. They might go through third or fourth grade, and then they're told that, you know, it's time to go get married and drop out of school. And I just think that, you know, in this world we live in with such abundance, it doesn't take much for us to roll up our sleeves and go make a difference somewhere where we can build a library for $2,000. We can build a school for $11,000 in Nepal, because the village residents are willing to donate land, willing to donate labor, and donating small amounts of money to the project under a program we call the Challenge Grant Program. The Challenge Grant is basically our way of saying to the village, we'll help you if you'll help yourself. You have to roll up your sleeves and put in that sweat equity to get the school built. So I think there's a lot we can do. We've opened 200 schools and we've opened 3,000 libraries in just our first 7 years at Room to Read. And there's some great photos on our website at roomtoread.org. But for us, that's really just the tip of the iceberg. We feel like we have so much further to go, and we hope that one day, you know, we can come on your show and announce we've done our 10,000th library or our 1,000th school.
Hmm. When you reassured that man that you would be back and that you would have books with you, how confident were you that, in fact, you would be back with books? I mean, were you absolutely sure?
I was absolutely sure that I intended to go back.
Right.
I knew in my heart that I would get back to the office and there would be the usual deadlines and deals and meetings and all that stuff. And what kept me the most honest was that my father got involved in the project. And he was retired at the time, living in Colorado. And he decided to help me collect books. And he then said to me, I want to go to Nepal with you. And I said, Dad, you're 73 years old. You're talking about being out in a place with no TV and no meat and, you know, sleeping in drafty little, you know, lodges that the Nepalese people have made in the mountains. And my dad laughed and said he survived World War II and the Depression. He thought he could survive a couple weeks in Nepal. So we put a date on our calendar to go back to Nepal a year later. And that was great for me because it was really a reason for me to leave work and take a couple weeks and go back and have that feeling of victory of walking back into that village with a bunch of donkeys, you know, overloaded with books. And putting those books in the hands of kids and watching their excitement, watching children who had never seen photographs of African wildlife, watching kids who had never seen sharks or the solar system have their first experience looking at these amazing concepts, watching their mouths just drop with excitement. And it was really on that day that I said to myself and to my father, you know, this may be my future. The technology and software may not be my future. It may not be about making rich people richer. It may be about helping the poor to gain this knowledge through education.
That's something I was struck with over and over again, and I'm sure a lot of people reading your book, is when we think about this amazing juxtaposition, or I mean, in some ways, it sort of seems like a disconnect. Not entirely. I mean, Microsoft, of course, and that whole industry is about the business of ideas and information and sharing them, and yet what you have ended up undertaking is so utterly different. In the way that information is delivered and shared, and who gets to be the recipient. I mean, you are affecting the lives of people who have no idea and probably never will have any idea what Microsoft even is.
That's true. I mean, I think so much of the world has right now what I would consider to be kind of a low-tech approach to education, which I think is where you have to start. If you're talking about a village in Africa that has no electricity, that doesn't have the telephone grid extended to them yet, what we really need to do is get kids to have qualified teachers, chalkboards, and access to books from a young age. They're very, very basic things. But I think when you know, all of us who have kids or all of us who love to read books, you know, can think about that, you know, glory of a trip to the library or the excitement of a bedtime story. And kids are always saying to their parents, please, please, can we read the book again or can we read a second or a third book? And what we really want to do at Room to Read is bring that same gift to kids throughout the developing world where they will grow up and they'll just think having a book and having a library is normal. Right now, they don't know what they're missing, but when you show them the books, their eyes get wide, their smiles get very, very huge, and we just feel really good about the fact that we've put about 2 million books in the hands of kids, and every day, nearly 1 million kids now have access to a Room to Read school or library.
Talk for a moment about the challenge of being a privileged American stepping into a very different culture and a very different country, and maybe the kind of cultural differences that prove to be a challenge in making this work. I mean, in you understanding exactly what was going on and the best way to go about making a difference. I mean, this had to be a little bit of a different experience than if you were doing this in a poverty-stricken region of Appalachia, for instance.
Yes, and I don't understand the countries that we work in well enough that I could ever make the decisions that need to be made as to where we work and how we work. And in the book, I talk quite a bit about the local teams we hire. We hire very smart Nepalese people in Nepal, Cambodians in Cambodia, Vietnamese people in Vietnam. And I know that sounds obvious, but so much of the charity world actually sends Americans overseas to boss the local people around. And we just don't believe in that model because we believe that you have to trust the Nepalese people to make the right decisions for Nepal. So our staff in these countries really does all of our outreach to these communities and works with them on the challenge grants, works with them on getting the library set up. And that, for us, really helps to overcome the cultural differences because what we're doing is providing the Nepalis a chance to help themselves through education, but we're not going to do everything for them. And we're certainly, from, you know, my office in San Francisco, I can't tell somebody in India what to do. I have to rely on my staff in India to know how to do the right thing.
Tell us some of the lessons which you have brought from your life at Microsoft to this particular work, and in particular those lessons which not only have made a difference in this particular project, Room to Read, but important lessons which you think are applicable probably across the board in the nonprofit sector.
I think first and foremost is a focus on results, a very intense focus on results. In the book, I talk about traveling with Steve Ballmer, and that Steve, you know, lives, eats, sleeps, breathes, results, results, results. And when I started Room to Read, we, in our signature file and email, which is the little thing that automatically appends to every email you send, we have a little stock ticker symbol at the bottom that lists out the number of schools we've opened, the number of libraries we've established, the number of books we've donated, the number of girls on scholarship. And we update those numbers on a quarterly basis. We tell our investors, and we call them investors, not donors, because they're investing in education. We tell our investors, you'll see those numbers going up every quarter. And if you don't, then you should challenge us on that. And I think that with the corporate world, they have to report the results on a quarterly basis if they're a public company and tell the world how they're doing. The charity world doesn't do that. The charity world kind of hides behind the fact of, oh, we're trying to do good things, so give us a break. And what I really want to do with Room to Read is establish a culture of performance and results where we can actually publicize, okay, we've, you know, in 2004 we opened our 1,000th library, in 2005 we opened our 2,000th, in 2006 we'll open our 3,000th. And I think people can really relate to that, especially the business people who give money to Room to Read, because they know that we're really focusing on getting those results out there and being accountable for reaching as many villages as possible.
When you undertook this, you were, materially speaking, a very blessed person. This may seem like, I think this is actually too personal a question to ask, but maybe you can answer it to some.
I can confirm for you that I'm half as blessed as I was when I left the company.
Okay. And I'm guessing still pretty blessed.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's always the elephant in the room question when you tell people you were at Microsoft and you left and everybody wants to know, like, you know, oh, were you one of those, you know, bazillionaires? And I was very fortunate that I saved enough money that I was able to work for no salary for the first 4 years and was able to bankroll the first year of Room to Read's existence just personally. I didn't make enough money that I could actually go do all this on my own. I can't afford to, you know, we're probably will, you know, spend about $7 million this year. So I have to go out and fundraise 100% of that money.
Right.
So we don't have any sugar daddies, unfortunately. We don't have any endowment. But it makes it more fun because what we do is we go out and connect with people. I was on the phone this morning with a donor who wants to endow a school in Nepal, and he was shocked that it only cost $11,000 to build an entire school building.
Right.
And for us, that's a lot of fun. If we had an endowment or if somebody gave us $1 billion, it wouldn't be nearly as fun as it is now. We're going out and we're telling people, did you know you can endow a girl's scholarship for $250? Did you know you can endow a school for $11,000? So lots of slideshows, lots of public speaking, lots of interviews, and hopefully a lot of people who will decide, hey, I'd like to be part of this, and hopefully make the world a better place.
Hmm. How has your daily life changed? And I guess I'm curious, this is the last question, by the way. I'm curious, I guess, in two different respects. I mean, very obviously, but I want you to speak to it. There are ways in which just the way you look at your life and the world and the difference you're making, I mean, has to be profoundly different from what it was once upon a time. But I also wonder if in more tangible ways, and I don't mean, well, you don't buy yachts anymore. I don't mean in that way exactly. But I mean in maybe other ways in your day-to-day life. How has this whole experience changed the way you live and maybe what is important to you?
I think the most important thing to me is to take my validation internally. When I left Microsoft, a lot of people told me I was crazy. And, you know, in the United States, when you go to a cocktail party or a dinner party, what's the first thing people ask you? What do you do?
Hmm.
What's your career? And I was going to go from saying I run business development for Microsoft China to, you know, I'm delivering books on the back of a yak and, you know, to rural Himalayan villages. And I think a lot of people thought I was absolutely, you know, had gone off the deep end. And I really, you know, in the book I talk about my father and I talking, my father said, don't look to other people for validation. If you believe in what you're doing, that's what matters the most. What's fortunate for us now, 7 years into it, is that Room to Read is open, as I mentioned, you know, 3,000 libraries and 200 schools. And so people who once thought I was crazy now are saying, oh, now I understand what you were doing. Now I understand that you know, why you're so passionate about this. So I think my life has changed in some ways. I certainly, you know, as I said, I'm half as blessed financially as I used to be. I really have run down my savings by living, you know, on no salary for the first 4 years. But I'm happier than I've ever been. I work more hours than I've ever worked, but I'm happier than I've ever been. And for me, when I can go into one of these villages, and in the book there's photos of some of these school opening ceremonies, and when I see a rural village that has never had a school before, and they have their red ribbons across the door, and there's a little band playing, and there's hundreds of parents and students who are out to greet us. That's for me. You couldn't give me enough money to go back to the corporate world.
That's sweeter than any yacht.
It really is. It really is. And if somebody out there wants to sell their yacht and endow some schools, we'd love to hear from them.
Great advice. The book is Leaving Microsoft to Change the World. It's published by HarperCollins, the author John Wood. John Wood, what an inspiring story this is, beautifully told in your wonderful book. Best wishes to you and to Room to Read.
Thank you, Greg. I enjoyed the interview.
And I am so happy to report to you that all of these years later, more than a decade later, the organization Room to Read is still in existence, flourishing, making a very powerful difference for the better in the world. And in fact, did all kinds of important work in the nation of Nepal in the wake of the terrible earthquakes there. And they have extended their reach to every continent on the planet except Antarctica. If you would like more information about Room to Read, you can go to their website, which is www.roomtoread.org. Tomorrow on the morning show, I'll speak with two people from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, including theater professor Lisa Kronetsky, about an upcoming event there designed to help people understand the importance of and value of copyright. The Morning Show is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Our weather forecast is for sunny, windy, warm conditions. We'll have a high temperature today of 83 degrees. Clear, breezy, and mild overnight with an overnight low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow, much like today, sunny skies and a high of 82 degrees. Thursday will actually warm all the way to 86 degrees with some clouds rolling in. By Thursday night and especially by Friday, we have a 50% chance of rain and our temperatures coming down over the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.